The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. And now we're going to return one more time to the April 22 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month, Paradise Found, the wild beauty of North Carolina's state parks. And we have talked about a lot of them, but this being the last reading of the month, you know what that means. Back of the magazine, 1980s, the decade of local heroes. This month's episode is entitled Pioneers of the Piedmont. When two scientists from Research Triangle Park win a Nobel Prize, their victory represents the fulfillment of the park's original mission, to make world-class science part of North Carolina's DNA. Written, as always, by Philip Gerard. In 1988, a team of researchers at Research Triangle Park, united by similar childhood traumas, makes history. Dr. George H. Hitchings and Gertrude Trudy Elion are awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, the first of an eventual 9 scientists from North Carolina to be so honored. Their achievement signals the validation of a vision conjured more than 30 years before, to create a high-powered incubator of applied science, allied to the 3 major universities in Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, and to stamp the state's signature on burgeoning high-tech industries. As the visionaries behind Research Triangle understood, science is a methodical way of thinking, experimenting, and problem-solving. Applied science requires not just asking the right question, but also asking that question in an original, productive way that can be made useful in everyday life. For generations, scientists have been searching for effective drugs to fight insidious diseases, malaria, arthritis, leukemia, every manner of bacterial infection. And though their research has yielded periodic breakthroughs, their method, trial and error, has been relatively primitive. Systematically test one natural substance or chemical after another to find one that works. It's a slow, laborious, expensive process that offers occasional lucky outcomes, but no guarantees. While working as a biochemist at the Wellcome Research Laboratory in New York, Hitchings pioneers a new approach. What if you turn the procedure around? Start with an analysis of the production of DNA and RNA in diseased cells and design a drug that will interfere with that process. He is inspired by the wartime success of sulfa drugs in disrupting the spread of bacterial infections. In 1944, Hitchings hires Elion, a part-time doctoral student at the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn, to be his lab assistant. At Hunter College, an all-woman campus with free enrollment, Elion achieved an outstanding academic record and earned a degree in chemistry. But as a woman in a male-dominated field, she was offered neither a fellowship nor a teaching assistantship to support her graduate studies and has paid her own way with a series of jobs, among them testing food products for the A&P grocery chain. The Polytechnic Institute then requires that Elion commit to attending full-time or quit the program. She casts her lot with Hitchings, a decision that becomes a career-long bond for both of them. The son and grandson of shipwrights in Eureka, California, Hitchings graduated cum laude in chemistry from the University of Washington in 1927. In 1933, he earned his Ph.D. as a teaching fellow at Harvard. He and his new wife, Beverly Reamer, set off to begin family and career as the country slid into the Great Depression. Hitchings recalls, "I experienced a 9-year period of impermanence, both financial and intellectual." In 1942, he signed on with the Wellcome Research Laboratories, which offered him the opportunity to design his own program of research. Elion was born in 1918, at the end of the Great War, to Russian and Lithuanian immigrants in New York City. The Depression drove her father, a dentist, into bankruptcy, and only the chance for a tuition-free study at Hunter College allowed her to pursue her passion for chemistry and research. After earning a master's degree from the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn and cobbling together a series of jobs in industrial chemistry and teachings, she landed the position with Hitchings, almost 13 years her senior. Despite their differences in age, geographical origin, and educational backgrounds, Hitchings and Elion both experienced the devastating loss of loved ones to illness at an early age. Now both are determined to prevent such needless suffering and death through their research. "When it came time at the end of my high school career to choose a major in which to specialize, I was in a quandary," Elion writes. "One of the deciding factors may have been that my grandfather, whom I loved dearly, died of cancer when I was 15. I was highly motivated to do something that might eventually lead to a cure for this terrible disease." Hitchings traveled much the same road. "My father died after a prolonged illness when I was 12 years old," he recounts. "A deep impression made by this event turned my thoughts toward medicine. This objective shaped my selection of courses in high school and expressed itself when I was salutatorian at my class graduation. I chose the life of Pasteur as the subject for my oration. The blending of Pasteur's basic research and practical results remained a goal throughout my career." Hitchings directs Elion to focus on the ingredients of DNA, specifically adenine and guanine, purines that are essential to cell growth. Once they identified the specific purines required for bacterial cells to produce DNA needed for cell growth, they designed synthetic ones called antimetabolites that mimic the natural purines and trick the enzymes of diseased cells into bonding with them instead, shutting down cell growth. The pair's first target is leukemia. Elion refines the synthetic purine molecule into one called 6-MP, which is successful in treating but not curing the disease. Many leukemia patients treated with 6-MP enjoy a period of remission but then relapse, often fatally. Elion is not satisfied. For 6 years, she works the problem, and after exhaustive testing, determines that 6-MP, augmented by other specific drugs, can indeed cure most childhood leukemia. It's a remarkable breakthrough, not just in saving lives, but also in validating the Hitchings-Elion method of designing such cures. In 1970, Wellcome Laboratories moves to Research Triangle Park. Wellcome's 300,000-square-foot facility, custom-designed by world-renowned modern architect Paul Rudolph, features a strikingly contemporary S-shaped layout, its steel trapezoidal frame supported by slanted columns. It's a signature investment for Burroughs Wellcome & Company, architectural proof of the British firm's commitment to innovation and creative research, and the only Rudolph-designed structure in the state. The Spaceship Building, as it comes to be known, houses 140 laboratories staffed by 400 employees, along with an auditorium and a cafeteria. At RTP, Hitchings and Elion applied their method to other medical problems. The drugs they designed to treat other forms of leukemia also suppress the immune system, a life-saving feature for patients who have undergone organ transplants and are at risk of having their immune systems reject the unfamiliar organs. Hitchings and Elion developed drugs to treat gout, malaria, septicemia, meningitis, and a host of other bacterial infections. Hitchings has already been rewarded for his innovative approach by promotion to Vice President of Research in 1967. But Like Elion, his passion is for the work, not the status it brings. My greatest satisfaction has come from knowing that our efforts helped save lives and relieve suffering, he writes. When I was baptized, my father held me up and dedicated my life to the service of mankind. I'm very proud that in some measure I have been able to fulfill his hopes. Nearly 20 years after arriving at RTP, Elion and Hitchings win the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. They share the honor with Sir James W. Black of King's College Hospital Medical School in London, himself a former Wellcome Foundation researcher. Elion remains at Wellcome until the end of her career, retiring as head of the Department of Experimental Therapy, a new paradigm for research laboratories, which by then includes about 50 scientists from diverse specialties. This department was sometimes termed by some of my colleagues a mini-institute, since it contains sections of chemistry, enzymology, pharmacology, immunology, and virology, as well as tissue culture laboratory. She explains, this made it possible to coordinate our work and cooperate in a manner that was extremely useful for the development of new drugs. She stays on at Wellcome as scientist emeritus and also accepts a position as research professor of medicine and pharmacology at Duke University, mentoring a new generation of researchers in her adopted state. Though unable to finish her doctorate as a young woman, Elion receives 25 honorary doctorates from such prestigious institutions as Brown University and the University of Michigan, among many other honors and awards. In his Nobel Prize banquet speech in Stockholm in 1988, Hitchings describes his and Elion's shared adventure of discovery. We were inspired by basic questions concerning the biochemistry of cellular reproduction, and the search led us on a journey filled with new knowledge and exciting discoveries. When William Faulkner accepted the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1949, he spoke of the verities of the human heart. Love and honor, pity and pride, compassion and sacrifice. As a scientist, I should like to suggest three verities of the human mind: curiosity, creativity, and the love of knowledge. The Nobel Prize in Medicine honors these truths, and we receive this recognition with humility and gratitude. Coming next month in our Decade of the 1980s series, Immigrants Enrich the Story of North Carolina. And now we've got one more story that's related to the theme of Paradise Found, the wild beauty of North Carolina's state parks. In Bladen County, this is called the safest place, by the way, in Bladen County, before integration, a former military man and his family were stewards of the first North Carolina state park open to black families. There, amid acres of longleaf pines and a sprawling lake, families and friends gathered to eat, play, and pray. Written by M.E.N. Wright. Nice picture here of a lake I think this is a cedar tree with Spanish moss hanging off of it. The caption says, DeWitt Powell was 53 in 1974 when the photo on the opposite page was taken near Jones Lake Picnic Area. He began as superintendent in the late 50s and served for the next 30 years. Young Velvet Powell was missing his shoe. Her dress, a flouncy, frilly trifle, was completely soaked, and now her mother would have to take down, wash, and restyle the child's long black hair. But that was the least of her worries. The honey brown 6-year-old had barely escaped drowning in Jones Lake. I could see the sunlight through the water over my head. I just couldn't get to it, Velvet Powell, Miles recalls with a chuckle 61 years later. In the end, it was her mother's careful grooming that saved her. Floating at the water's surface was Velvet's thick, plaited rope of hair. A family friend spotted it and hauled her back, braid first, onto the boathouse dock. It was one of many instances of luck, or favor, as the saints say, that the Powell family enjoyed as stewards of Jones Lake State Park. It wasn't that Jones Lake was dangerous. Quite the opposite. North Carolina's first state park to admit black visitors opened its gates in 1939 with acres upon acres of longleaf pines, camping acres, and the biggest draw, a huge, shallow, rust-colored lake teeming with perch. The sandy shore at Carolina Bay Lake was perfect for a dip, boating, or casual fishing. And with its hiking and campground amenities, the park became popular overnight. Mr. DeWitt Powell came on as the park's first black superintendent in the early 50s. Sally Powell, his wife, was a respected math teacher. The family lived on the premises in a house tucked on a dirt road off the main track, its brown wood blending into the foliage. The special part was looking out onto the water, which was a reddish brown because of the leaves from the cypress trees. It was very pretty to me and free, Velvet says. We were free to just run all over everywhere and be ourselves. Elizabethtown, the closest municipality, was about 5 miles away and separated by a bridge, leading to the feeling that the park was in a world of its own. The Powell children's classmates envisioned the lake where as a 224-acre pool that they could swim in whenever they pleased, and the park and shelters their backyard for picnics. Few in Elizabethtown called the park by its government name. It was simply Mr. DeWitt's Lake, a safe harbor from the racial malice of 1950s North Carolina. And Velvet, Powell's only daughter, felt nowhere safer. When I look back, I realize that we were very blessed, she says. I didn't recognize racism at the time because I thought what we had was pretty much normal. I'm sure Daddy faced a lot of opposition and many things that we never knew about, but he never mentioned them. As a child, I never heard of the battles that he may have had. Powell ran the park with military precision. He'd taken a year of college before enlisting in the U.S. Army, where he quickly achieved the rank of sergeant. But a perforated eardrum returned him to civilian life. Under his watch, the gates never opened a minute late, and the park had the reputation of being the cleanest in the state. North Carolina Digital Collections has letters written by guests from across the country. Interestingly, Jones's Lake's status as a Negro park did not deter white people from visiting, and some of their letters were complimentary. Mr. and Mrs. Alvin Roy of Bell, West Virginia, wrote to the North Carolina State Parks Department on September 8, 1967, gushing over one of the most beautiful parks we have ever visited. They were amazed at the cleanliness of the facilities and found the staff kind and courteous, even though we were of a different race. We never turned anyone away because of their race, Velvet said. A lot of the campers were white, but black people mainly enjoyed the water. A fanatic about litter, DeWitt Powell instructed his staff, if it doesn't grow, pick it up, remembers Charles McCoy, who worked summers at the park for 16 years. Every speck of paper, every cigarette butt was removed daily, as well as some things that did grow. He was strict with that. Oh, my God, McCoy says. Would you believe that we had to rake the ground of pine needles every day? In addition to out-of-town visitors, the black community around Jones Lake embraced the park with fervor as if it were a second home. The park hosted family reunions and church picnics and even planned a Negro bathing beauty contest back in 1944. But most common during summers were the baptisms. Black churches in the area did not have baptismal pools, so Powell scheduled ritual services at the lake before the park opened on Sundays. Sometimes twice on Sunday mornings, church buses would pull into the parking lot and parishioners would crowd the shore. Candidates in white waded into the lake behind their pastors who prayed over them and then dipped them backward into the water, symbolic of going down into the grave. They broke back into the air, greeted by shouts of joy. Jones Lake was a haven for black residents, but it still operated with the constraints of its time. The buildings weren't modern. The bathhouse where visitors kept their clothes and other items while they swam did not have lockers. Rather, a system of unsecured, numbered baskets kept order. On days with many visitors, these baskets covered the floors. The commodes and sink were old as well. McCoy says that he was sometimes embarrassed by the state of accommodations, but Powell's exacting standards still had to be met. It's a shame the way they underfunded black facilities back then, when we paid the same taxes, McCoy says. To compensate, the staff scrubbed everything constantly, checking the bathrooms 4 and 5 times a day to make sure they were up to par. He kept the gold standard, McCoy says of Powell, and if you couldn't do that, you had to hit the road. But he took all of us under his wing, and he made men out of us. In fact, Powell made a mission of mentoring youth. He hired students from Fayetteville State University's swim program to be lifeguards and recruited young men in the community as workers. If parents came to him worried that their sons were at risk of falling into trouble, Powell provided constructive work and a safe place to blow off steam. They would work all day doing whatever Daddy said. "I want you to pick up this paper. I want you to take this over there," Velvet remembers. When they finished, they could go swimming. And he would feed them. Those mentorships led to lifelong bonds of respect and loyalty. Now in his 70s, McCoy still casually refers to Powell as my dad. Years after Powell retired and grew infirm, McCoy, a barber, would come by and cut his hair. J.C., another son who worked at the park in his youth, would come by and shave him or assist with baths. It was just nothing they would not do for him, Velvet says. When they needed it, he had made their lives meaningful. The Jones Lake State Park of today is nearly unrecognizable to its former residents' family. Renovations have expanded the covered picnic shelter, and the bathhouse has been completely rebuilt. A visitor center greets the guests who used to knock on Powell's door. A new trail offers access to the 315-acre Salters Lake, another Carolina Bay in the park. A bright, air-conditioned classroom rings with voices of visitors in summertime, replacing the shouts of a Sunday morning Holy Ghost good time. Some things haven't changed, though. The Bay Trail, a 4-mile loop around Jones Lake, still offers gentle sounds of lapping waves and trilling birds. The water, which Velvet loved looking out over as a child, is that same rich reddish brown, evoking that same sense of peace. But the purpose of the special place has evolved. Now the legal right to enjoy all of North Carolina's abundant natural beauty is afforded to everyone, and Jones Lake survives as a testament. The only state park where, from the very beginning, all visitors within its gates could feel unabashedly free. Jones Lake State Park is on North Carolina Highway 242 in Elizabethtown, North Carolina. Let's see if we have time to read about the city of Goldsboro. Inspired by her family's deep Wayne County roots, a business owner showcases her hometown's multicultural cuisine, rich history, and vibrant art scene. This is written by Katie King. The streetwear boutique that Kimber Roche and her brothers Derek and Joshua own in downtown Goldsboro is a tribute to their family and their hometown. Inside Rye Always Fresh, one wall is covered with newspaper clippings featuring town and family history, including Wilbur L. Rye, her grandfather, who was a well-known butcher in the area. Nods to Rye are present throughout the store. A glass butcher display case holds the latest high-end sneakers, and the checkout counter resembles one you might find in an old-school grocery store. The concept of the shop was built around our family heritage, Roche says. We love to express style and fashion throughout art, history, and music. Roche was named the 2021 North Carolina Main Street Champion for her work with Goldsboro's Downtown Merchants Association. It's a very vibrant downtown because of the arts, the history, and the diverse cultures, she says, but we still have that small-town feel. While she and some of her siblings have moved away from time to time, they keep coming back. We've all traveled, we've all been to big cities, Roche says, but our parents always taught us, remember where you came from, remember your roots. This is our hometown, and we want to give back to the community we were raised in. So let's learn about some of the places there. Under the heading Shop, Rye Always Fresh. Roche's brothers Derek and Joshua combined their skills as a celebrity stylist and an artist, respectively, to open their dream store in 2018. They wanted to bring something new and different to their hometown, Roche says, and boy did they. Inspired by the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the shop is a curated collection of premium brands, vintage and designer clothes and shoes, plus Rye's own brands designed by Derek. the picket fence. Teresa and Henry Stevens offer their own line of handmade 100% soy candles and goat's milk soap. Farmhouse decor, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, and homemade barbecue sauce. Live edge maple, mahogany, and black walnut charcuterie and cutting boards. And custom dining room tables that Henry makes in the back. Check out the flower boxes at Brisas Latin Cuisine. Henry made those, too. And Cry Freedom Missions Shop. The retail branch of Cry Freedom Missions, a local nonprofit dedicated to helping survivors of human trafficking, uses all of the store's proceeds for outreach, shelter, and other organizational functions while giving survivors the opportunity to engage in meaningful work. Every purchase that you make has purpose, Roche says, and the products are beautiful. They have the best earrings. Want to eat? B&G Grill. You walk in and everyone knows your name, Roche says, of this mom-and-pop diner, which was founded by the late Grace and Bruce Bowser Raines in 1977 and is now owned by their son, Bruce, above right in this picture with his son, Holt. You can come any day between 6 a.m. and 2 p.m., and this huge parking lot will be packed. Barrique. Barrique, the French word for wine barrel, is an upscale restaurant and bar. Downstairs, a wine cellar offers a world of options for customers to take home or to drink with their steak or pasta dishes. Upstairs, at the 18th Amendment Lounge, a pre-prohibition-inspired drink menu features barrel-aged whiskeys and craft cocktails. How about the Thai Garden? The owner of this authentic Thai restaurant, Janet Jasari, used to be the chef for the royal family of Thailand. Now she serves traditional Thai dishes made with herbs from her organic garden. If you go and visit her, she'll greet you with a tangerine, Roche says. In Thailand, they often greet people with a tangerine or an orange or a piece of candy. Now, if you're interested in playing, how about the Goldsboro Brew Works? This veteran-owned and operated brewery features 30 taps, a bottle shop, a dog-friendly back patio, and an arcade, making it a popular hangout for families. The 1913 building still has its original exposed brick walls, pressed-in tin ceiling, and concrete floors. Or the Wayne County Museum. The 1927 Woman's Club building, also a former USO location, now houses a museum filled with rotating and permanent exhibits on Wayne County's history. These two ladies are keeping history alive in Wayne County, Roche says, of Executive Director Jennifer Kuykendall and Assistant Director Anna Mitchell. If you want to learn more, you can go to ourstate.com/downtown-Goldsboro. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I hope you enjoyed it so much that you'll be sure to come back next week, same time, same place, for another edition. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any questions or comments, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.